May it please the court, my name is Chris Kelly. I represent Marvin Artley in this appeal from his conviction for a drug crime. Mr. Artley admitted at his plea hearing that he sold about 2 ounces of cocaine. He was sentenced on an amount that was about 10 times that amount. It's our contention that the information upon which that sentence was based was not sufficiently reliable to justify that drug quantity finding. Mr. McCoy makes a similar reliability argument in his brief. I'm going to be discussing reliability generally. Mr. Anderson, on behalf of Mr. McCoy, will be discussing, I believe, the breach of the plea agreement issue that Mr. McCoy raised. Assessing witness reliability at sentencing is particularly crucial when the drug quantity balloons at sentencing the way it did in this case. It ballooned on the basis of hearsay that was regurgitated in a police report that was never cross-examined and then, in fact, was never even furnished to the defense until after the plea hearing. Because witness reliability is so important under those circumstances, this court has created a number of rules to help district court judges assess reliability. And those include not relying upon inconsistent statements made by an informant, at least without resolving those inconsistencies, and being particularly skeptical of statements that are made by drug users, and in particular drug users turned informant. As Mr. McCoy's brief points out, statements are typically presumed unreliable when they're obtained as a result of government involvement and are never cross-examined.
Why?
I'm sorry?
Why? That's certainly not my understanding of the rules. Why would statements of informants be presumed unreliable?
Well,
there are an awful lot of people who are sent to their death on the basis of statements of informants.
Well, there certainly have been, but in the context of the Confrontation Clause, Your Honor.
Confrontation Clause has no bearing at sentencing.
But the principles that underlie the Confrontation Clause.
We've held the opposite many times. So just
I agree with
that,
Your Honor.
And let's just concentrate on the question, what kind of treatment is appropriate for this is a matter over which the judiciary can make up its own mind.
Well, again, I think the treatment is that when a statement hasn't gone through the crucible of cross-examination and therefore hasn't been...
Well, was there any problem with your cross-examining these people if you wish to?
Well, I can't cross-examine a pre-sentence report and the...
Sure you can. All you do is call the person to the stand for cross-examination. Was there any problem in cross-examining these people if you would wish to do so?
Well, could I have issued subpoenas and brought them into court? I suppose I could have, but it's not my burden to do that because I don't have the burden of proving drug quantities at sentencing.
I can certainly understand a concern if what we've got is anonymous hearsay, so the defendant doesn't know who he needs to call in and cross-examine. But it seems a much weaker point if the defendant says, in effect, gee, if I bring this person in and cross-examine him, the evidence may just get worse, so let's not do that. And then comes to the Court of Appeals and says it shouldn't have been believed.
Well, Your Honor, with all due respect, it wasn't my position that the evidence is going to get worse. It was my position that I don't have to prove drug quantity. That's the government's job at sentencing. And if I'm presented with a pre-sentence report that bases information on inconsistent statements given by witness informants, I'm entitled to point that out to the court, to point out that those inconsistencies are not reliable, and to argue to the court that the government hasn't done its job. It hasn't used reliable information to resolve those inconsistencies. And the problem in this case is that those inconsistencies certainly exist, and the witness reliability problem certainly exists, but the court made no finding that would have resolved those inconsistencies. Instead, the court simply read into the record portions of the pre-sentence report without explaining why it found the portions it read into the record more reliable than the portions it didn't read into the record, which were contradictory. And that, I don't think, is what Rule 38I means when it tells the court that it has to resolve those inconsistencies. The government, with respect to Mr. Artley, relied basically on 4 witnesses. One of them actually bought drugs from Mr. Artley, and we don't object to that drug quantity. But it also relied upon 3 witnesses who did not buy drugs from Mr. Artley. One of them was Catherine Verdon, who twice claimed that she bought drugs from Mr. Artley, not that she bought drugs from Mr. Artley, but that she bought drugs at Mr. Artley's apartment at a time when she says Mr. Artley was present, when we know from other sections of the pre-sentence report that Mr. Artley was in jail and could not have been present. Now, when a witness is twice telling a lie and that lie gets regurgitated in the pre-sentence report, I think when I point out to the judge that this could not be true, and that the judge therefore needs to make a finding as to why anything Catherine Verdin says is reliable, the judge should address that objection. Instead, the district court simply read into the record what Catherine Verdin said without resolving the problems with Catherine Verdin's credibility. The second witness that the pre-sentence relied upon and that the court apparently relied upon was Alicia Smith. She claims also that she bought drugs at the apartment, at Mr. Artley's apartment. She said that Mr. Artley was only there about half of the time she did that, and she refused to do business with him because she didn't trust him. The judge didn't explain why he thought that Ms. Smith was in a position to even see what was going on if she didn't trust, or Mr. Artley was in a position to see what was going on if she didn't trust Mr. Artley. And finally, there is William McCoy, but what William McCoy does is blame Jerry McCoy and say they're Jerry's drugs, and Jerry blames William McCoy, and that contradiction doesn't get resolved. So it's our basis that, or it's our position that this was not sufficiently reliable information to satisfy due process. I don't want to cut into Mr. Anderson's time, so I will yield my time to him at this point.
Thank you, Mr. Kelly.
Thank you.
Mr. Anderson?
May it please the Court, I'm Kent Anderson with the Federal Defender's Office of the Central District of Illinois, representing the appellant Jerry McCoy. And unless the Court asks questions about the other issues, I'm just going to discuss the breach of the plea agreement and, if I have time, the fine issues today. As part of the plea agreement, the government agreed to file a motion for reduction of sentence if Mr. McCoy provided substantial assistance before sentencing, and government apparently made that determination. It told the probation officer that it was going to file such a motion. At sentencing, the prosecutor stated that Mr. McCoy had provided very significant cooperation in several cases, including some homicides, both here and at other locations, but they didn't file a motion for a reduced sentence on that basis. Now, once the government made the determination that Mr. McCoy had provided substantial assistance, the language in the plea agreement obligated them to ask the a court to reduce the sentence accordingly. But the government now argues that the statement, if the defendant provides substantial assistance before sentencing, the United States agrees to move the court to impose a sentence reflecting that assistance, doesn't mean what it says. Instead, it relies on a later sentence, says the decision whether to make such a request based upon substantial assistance rests entirely within the government's discretion. And if that sentence stood alone, the government could have determined that Mr. McCoy provided substantial assistance and said, well, we don't think a motion's appropriate anyhow. But the sentences have to be read together. And when doing so, that shows the government had absolute discretion to decide whether Mr. McCoy provided substantial assistance. But once they made that determination, they then had to make a motion for reduced sentence.
Mr. Anderson, I recognize the thrust of that argument, but haven't we addressed it by saying unless there's an affirmative position taken by the government, we won't review it for bad faith? I think in Burrell.
That's the gist of it, yes. But when they said that Mr. McCoy had provided significant cooperation in several cases, that was an affirmative position that...
Or at a minimum, you think it's internally inconsistent, I guess, that make that statement and then...
And then failed to ask for a reduced sentence, yes. If they had not made that statement, I don't think I would have an issue here on appeal. but they did, and as you said, the government has a duty to act in good faith. Now, they're saying the significant cooperation doesn't equal substantial assistance, but nowhere in any case that I could find is substantial assistance given a meaning other than the ordinary dictionary definition. And significant and substantial are both synonyms that mean important. Cooperate means to work or act together toward a common end or purpose, and assistance is to aid or help. You can't, that to me means they mean the same thing. And since I'm running out of time, moving on, I will just say that the court also imposed a $50,000 fine in spite of the finding that Mr. McCoy only had a $6,745 net worth with his wife. That shows that he couldn't afford to pay that much. I mean, some fine might have been appropriate, but not to that extent when he's got a 328-month sentence. Sure, he had $524,500 in assets, but he also had $517,755 in liabilities at the time of sentencing. So any wealth that he may have amassed earlier was apparently gone, and the court had to look at what he had at the time of sentencing.
Did the government suggest an amount in this case?
No. And neither did the probation officer. Inconsistently said this was his assets, but a fine within between $20,000 and $2 million, which was the guideline range. without considering, of course, the needs of his defendants. And the court didn't adopt that, the net worth finding, but it didn't make its own findings. So at best, it's inconsistent, which would require a reversal and remand. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Mr. Anderson. Mr. Anderson?
Good morning. My name is Jeff Anderson. I'm an assistant U.S. attorney in Madison, Wisconsin, and I was responsible for the investigation and prosecution of the Jerry McCoy drug conspiracy. And from 1999 to approximately 2004, Mr. McCoy was involved in a large drug conspiracy with a number of partners, including, for at least 2 years, the other co-conspirator, Marvin Artley. Now, both of them were arrested in 2004 after a series of controlled buys. Both pled guilty, and as the court is aware, a pre-sentence report was prepared. It was extremely thorough, and this pre-sentence report was based on drug buys, search warrants, a number of cooperating witnesses who corroborated each other, and drugs found at the scene of the shooting. Ultimately, the pre-sentence recommended that Mr. Artley have a guideline range of 0.5 to 2 kilos, and Mr. McCoy 15 to 50 kilos. I would submit that this was very conservative, and we'll get into this in just a minute. In addition, Mr. McCoy agreed to cooperate.
Let me ask briefly, what was the point of saying that he had rendered substantial assistance to you and then not making a motion when the plea agreement said you would?
Two things. Number one, the plea agreement merely outlines what the status of the law is.
I know what it is. Okay. I read it. Go ahead.
The problem we face on cooperation, where the individuals provided a lot of cooperation,
right,
is that it's a continuum. And it's our position that if an individual provides cooperation and that cooperation is completed prior to sentence, we will make a 5K1 motion. If the cooperation is not completed after sentence...
Is that what you told the court? Did you tell the court he hadn't completed it?
We told the court, and I think it's reflected in the transcript, that we anticipate filing a Rule 35 motion for Mr. McCoy, which we did. We ultimately did file a Rule 35 motion. And in the Western District of Wisconsin, trial attorneys want the Rule 35 motion. They want their clients to be able to testify before the sentencing court. And the defendants want the Rule 35 motion, as does the government, because we want cooperation to be completed.
It baffles me how you expect people to cooperate if the idea is when they do cooperate, nothing helps them anyway.
Well, except it helps them to the Rule 35 motion down the road.
Oh.
I mean...
And that was pointed out to the court when you went through this.
Right, and that was represented to Judge Shabazz that we anticipate filing a Rule 35 motion, and the benefit is the same for the defendant. And like I say, most trial lawyers in the Western District of Wisconsin, most defendants, and clearly the government, would rather have the Rule 35 motion than the 5K1 motion because the sentencing court gets to see them testify, and they get to complete all of their cooperation.
Oh.
So what was your position at the conclusion of the motion?
The conclusion of the Rule 35 motion?
Yeah.
Judge Shabazz withdrew it since this appeal is pending at this time. So the Rule 35
motion... So it didn't do him a bit of good, is what you're suggesting.
Pardon me?
So it didn't do him a bit of good, is what you're suggesting.
We anticipate it still will once this appeal is done. We anticipate Judge Shabazz will take it back then and will grant a downward departure.
Knowing the kindness of his heart, you recognize he'll immediately reduce the sentence.
Would you repeat that? I'm sorry.
Yeah, I said knowing the kindness of Judge Shabazz's heart, he'll immediately reduce the sentence.
Well, the government will still make that, will certainly make that recommendation.
You'll make the recommendation to reduce the sentence?
Absolutely, with the Rule 35 motion. I mean, we were clearly operating in good faith. There's no question about that. I mean, what can we do with an individual who provides information on, say, five other individuals? And it takes a while to work up these drug cases. And at the time he's sentenced, in this case, Mr. McCoy, we're not done. We haven't concluded that investigation.
Interesting.
But you go forward with an indictment of the individual.
Of Mr. McCoy or the other?
No, Mr. McCoy.
Oh, we have to.
No, I'm not questioning that. But this temporal aspect of when you determine substantial assistance can be, you know, an awesome power that can be troubling. For example, if after a review of it all, substantial assistance, in other words, 85%, if we could break it down to that, Mr. Anderson, is completed at the time of sentence. But you know, these drug cases can go on for quite a while, as you can see the relation back that you have here into the 90s on relevant conduct.
Certainly.
Which is its own challenge, it seems to me, for a district judge in weighing memory and of cooperating folks, and as was evidenced by
absolutely
Mr. Kelly's pointing out, you know, somebody's in jail when they're supposed to be selling drugs and the like.
Right.
It seems to me that, you know, if the government is pretty comfortable that substantial assistance has been provided, that ought to be made very clear and not rely on the vehicle, the motion for the 35 motion.
The problem we face is that frequently the defense attorneys themselves would rather have the Rule 35 motion. We discussed this with the defense attorneys.
And so to show the, to draw out the sympathy of the court for the way the person testifies? I guess give me the logic why defense lawyers want that. I know you're not a defense lawyer, at least not currently, but what is this logic that you say they want it for?
Well, they want the sentencing court to see what a good witness this individual. The fact that he's testified, that he's telling the truth, and that he's provided cooperation against another number of individuals, and that he's willing to go forth and testify at a trial against his co-conspirators.
How can that be better than the government saying that?
Oh, we'll say it too.
Yeah, but why? If I'm a defense lawyer, why would I put a witness, my defendant, on the stand to say it if I've got the United States swearing that he is going to be a very strong witness? I just don't see the plus of this. It's just to give the humanity of the individual to have some contact between the judge and the defendant?
No, not that so much. I think it's just the fact that it gives them the opportunity to see that this individual is willing to tell the truth. All I can say is that we discuss these with defense attorneys all the time.
So this was done with the full knowledge and acquiescence of the defense attorney?
In this particular case, it was discussed with Mr. Ryan, and Mr. Ryan knew that we were not going to file a 5K1 at this point, and we indicated on the record that we anticipated filing a Rule 35 down the road.
And he thought that was a good idea.
I can't tell you. I mean, I can't speak for Mr. Ryan. I can't say.
Well, the record doesn't show that he said anything against it, you say.
That is correct.
It doesn't say that he asked for the reduction or asked for the government to live up to their original promise?
I would submit that the government made no promise at that point. I mean,
the government made a promise that if he gave full and substantial benefit, that you would make a motion to reduce the sentence.
Correct. And it's the government's position that he hadn't completed his substantial assistance.
Yeah, well, as Judge Flom points out, I mean, you could drag that on forever, too. I mean, there's more to it. It can go on and on. We're not sure he's fully up to it. He's given an awful lot, but, you know, who knows what else might happen.
One of the problems is we can only go back to the court so many times. And if we go to the court...
Yeah, but you can do it the first time and get it over with.
Well, candidly, one of the problems is if we file the 5K1 motion and the individual is then sentenced, there's no incentive for him to continue to cooperate if we can't go back and file a Rule 35 motion.
Well, but he allegedly has cooperated to a significant degree, or he wouldn't be filing the 5K1 motion, right?
That is correct. But the problem is he hasn't completed the cooperation.
Well, you think he'll get up and lie and testify and wind up with a perjury indictment? There's your club.
Yeah.
He's already cooperated. He's given you all the statements you need under oath. You took him to a grand jury, I assume.
We frequently do.
Yeah, and so having done that, you think that you still need this club because otherwise he'd walk away from him and leave you stuck with an indictment only for perjury. That doesn't make sense at all.
Well, that's one of the possibilities, that, as we say, they will go south on us. They will no longer cooperate.
Well, you'd have a difficult time trying to convince me I ought to have a cooperating client if I were a defense lawyer. If you're going to renege on a deal or you're going to drag it out any way you want, I could be there forever. Or do what happens here, get sentenced, right, and comes up here and prays a lot.
And clearly I can sense that the court is troubled with this issue, and I can tell you that we struggle with them within the office. We have a senior management team that reviews all of the 5K1 motions and Rule 35 motions, and we spend...
Well, consider this a senior management team here, and take a sweat at it.
I certainly do.
Young judge.
I certainly do.
Well, you can see, Mr. Anderson, in where a court could be a little concerned when what one is indicted for would bring X number of years. And through relevant conduct, we go to 10 years and 27 years, and I'm not at this point questioning the appropriateness of the sentence.
Understood.
And where a 5K1 might be a significant aspect in what that sentence could otherwise be. And we've spoken to this sort of backdoor increase, which the executive through the Justice Department can do. You can, at least I sense, you should sense for me, some unease by this so-called practice that the Western District thinks is favorable to defendants. But I'll leave it at that. Let me just ask you one question about this fine.
Yes.
The government just thinks that's a possible, that's a, just stood silent with that 50,000 figure.
Well, admittedly, he
I don't know what he's going to be paid in prison, but...
Admittedly, he had a net worth of $6,000, but when the court looked at it, he had made deposits of $800,000 on several...
No question about the drug dealing.
Right.
But I guess the reality is, comes into play, what are we going to get here? I guess
and
the government can get a statistic of fines collected, you know, it's sort of, maybe that helps dealing with Congress, I don't know.
I wouldn't think so. Not in this case. That wasn't a very good answer to your question.
That's all right. Thank you, Mr. Anderson. Mr. Kelly? All right. Mr. Anderson? Yeah.
Things I would notice the court has alluded to. This court and other courts have said Rule 35 is for post-sentence cooperation. There, you know, it's a clear dividing line there. And in this case, you know, when a defendant provides substantial assistance prior to sentencing, should move for reduction. If they provide more later, then Rule 35 comes into play.
Mr. Anderson, as your namesake has suggested, we got a counsel here who chose this vehicle.
That I wouldn't know, since I, you know, wasn't trial counsel. I can't imagine why he did, but it's possible. I honestly don't know. But I will also note that the Rule 35 motion that was filed was untimely, and the court rejected the filing without an explanation. I know that my office would rather have the 5K1 when the defendant's before the court rather than the Rule 35 when he usually appears by phone later. And sentencing can always be continued until cooperation is complete. And the incentive for further cooperation after the...
You don't do that in the Central District of Illinois, this practice?
It's not commonly. You know, I'd have to talk to the trial division to see what the percentage of cases is. I know it's not done all the time, and we try not to have it that way, but... And, of course, I was going to say the incentive for further cooperation is a further reduction of sentence. And the defendant's probably more likely to cooperate further when he doesn't have a bad taste in his mouth after sentencing about what happened. With respect to the fine, I'd also note that the plea agreement called for Mr. McCoy to forfeit his interest in his house, too. So even that was gone. It's something to pay.
All right.
Thank you, Your Honors.
All right, thanks to all counsel. Mr. Kelly, first of all, an additional thanks to you for accepting the appointment in this case. And Mr. Anderson, a thanks to you and the Central District Federal Defender for going up north and taking this appeal, and to both of you for ably representing the interests of the defendants.